Group meeting, Sunday, 5th August, 1984. I have had a very definite purpose since last September in saying all the things that you have heard since that month. It is absolutely essential to become free of all the absurd ideas that have conditioned us through the ages, in fact. I'm referring, of course, to the sphere of religion as such. So many of the teachings I consider as completely false. Take, for instance, the idea of rebirth. There is only one true meaning to rebirth in our daily life. It is the association of the self-consciousness, which we term I am I, with every single thought, feeling, event, action which takes place. There, of course, we are reborn. I am reborn in the next thought, in the next feeling, in the next action, and so forth. But after the death of the psychophysical organism, everything that composes that psychophysical organism disintegrates. It goes back to its primordial source. Those transcendent energies, which we have called God or the divine spark or the immortal spirit, the immortal soul, whatever that may represent, is once again just that immortal soul and nothing else. And whatsoever is immortal is the totality, is a totality. That which was put together and formed a living human being, when that perishes, then all those elements, the body, the psyche, the soul or spirit or whatever, mind or whatever else is there, is once again part and parcel of the universal total. And there is no identifiable entity left over. See, the very term immortal soul attached to each person is a complete mistake. Whatsoever is immortal, is infinite, is eternal. You can't chop it up into pieces and attach a bit of that infinite eternal to any particular body or object or thing. You can't do it. Try and cut up space, for instance. Slice off slabs of space and stick your nameplate on them. Can you do it? You can't. So this idea of an immortal soul is utterly absurd. Again, it is taught that after the death of the existential being, the person in the world, this immortal soul undergoes judgment. And it is sentenced either to a heaven or a hell for all time. How is it possible for a limited, finite human being so to live as to produce an infinite consequence? If one is the supreme power, whatever that may be, or energy, which creates the entire universe, one could so live as to produce infinite consequences, maybe. But we can't do that. When we on earth die, there is no such thing as a heaven or hell afterwards. I am particularly concerned with this point because human beings have lived in fear and terror throughout the ages. This fear of the torments of hell. And they have lived good lives, or tried to live good lives, only for the reward of heaven. But this is all absurdity altogether. There's no such thing as punishment or reward after the death of the individual. The individual affects the totality. The totality affects the individual. I do something which affects my entire environment, the whole world maybe. And the whole world and I reap the consequences of it. Whilst I am alive, when I am dead, that's the end. Absolute end. So let us be free, altogether free, of any sort of fear of hell or any sort of anticipation of a reward afterwards. The totality functions through us, through each and every one of us, through each and every animal, plant, atom in the universe. And the totality experiences the changes that take place because of the specific activity of the individual or the animal or whatever it is. And so the idea of the ideas which have been presented regarding karma, that whatsoever you sow, you will reap. But you are never the exclusive and sole agent of what you sow. So many factors, hundreds of factors, have played their part in making me think a particular thought, feel a particular feeling, and perform a particular action. So I am not the exclusive agent. Whatsoever then I do brings a certain immediate result in my own psychophysical constitution. As for the rest, there's no such thing as a karma held over. This is where the Hindu presentation of it is utterly absurd. There is the karma of the past, there's the karma of the present, and there's the karma of the future. In any case, who keeps these accounts? I don't. Do you? And if God does, God help him. What sort of a ledger book has he to keep in order to work out all these accounts? And how is he, if there is, assuming that there is an individual like God, you see, how is he to apportion out just this, that and the other for the incredibly countless millions of people and things which take place in the world? It's impossible. These are all absurd ideas. The very idea of survival after death is a very absurd idea. Consider what happens. We have had a very, very long evolution, lasting through at least about 500 million years. First, we had fish whose fins were gradually evolving into legs. And they became amphibious, lived on the sea, lived on the land. They were followed by the reptiles about 400 million years ago. And about 55 or 60 million years after the reptiles started, there emerged the mammals. And the more advanced group of mammals, the primates, were the origin from which we ultimately evolved. The mammals, the advanced mammals, the Hominoidea family, it was a super family, it can be regarded from two points of view. One was the Cercopithecoids, mostly in South America, and the others were in Asia and in Africa. Now, they ultimately evolved into erect man, Homo erectus, starting about 4 million years ago in Tanzania and Ethiopia. Then followed about 1.5 million years ago, the changes took place, began to take place then, which ended with Homo sapiens as such. Now, in the brain of man and the brains of all animals, there is the result of all that past evolution. We ourselves contain all that controls our biological functions, and we also contain in our brains, right at the back here, you see, the brain stem is surrounded by these, the reptilian group, from which we derive our aggressiveness, our fear, and various other unpleasant aspects like that. Then the mammalian part of the brain is the apparatus which deals with the more kindly part, because the reptiles laid eggs. The mammals produced live young. And with the mammals, they are developed care for the young and protection and so forth. And then so on, we come to Homo sapiens. Now, Homo sapiens comes on the scene something like 1.5 million years, a little later than that. But Homo, the archaic Homo sapiens, the one that preceded the Neanderthalers too, the archaic humans knew something about the use of fire, and they had developed tribal groups, and these tribal groups were sometimes at war with each other. In fact, more often than not, when a man killed another man, he being the stronger person, and God is first and foremost called Almighty, and has been called Almighty from the very beginning of time, because he was stronger and he ruled, he killed somebody, and then later on dreamt of him. And you know how it is, what it is like in a dream. Your legs won't run, your arms have lost their strength, the man you killed is free from you. You can't do anything about him. Then that man, the killer, woke up and was in a state of fear and terror. But I killed that man at such and such a time, at such and such a place. Is he alive? And I couldn't do anything at all last night when I saw him. He's quite convinced that he absolutely saw him, the same person. I couldn't do anything against him. So when several people, by their hundreds probably and thousands, had dreams like that, they must have come to the conclusion that somehow, in some mysterious form, that person, that identical individual, survives. And he survives in a form which, against which I have no power any longer. So he became afraid, and he thought that he should somehow or other make friends with him. And the whole business of placatory rights and all the rest of the stuff came into being. And just as we have tribes, and the chief of the tribe, and when tribes get together and form a bigger group, there is a chief at the top of that, and so on, so perhaps those spirits all have chiefs amongst them, and the supreme chief is God. And since the chief is the strongest person, not necessarily the wisest, but the strongest person, therefore God became almighty. All these ideas are projections out of our own brains through the ages as a result of our ignorance and our fears. We have never challenged the idea of survival. So we've just taken it for granted. Even the great founders of the religions have taken it for granted. Now we must remember, as I've said this before, that the founders of the religions have been regarded by their followers as omniscient, that they can make no mistake whatsoever. Now let us make no mistake that nobody has ever been omniscient in that sense. We are all fallible. There is nothing which is infallible. Even the laws of nature sometimes get set aside, as we know from modern physics and the results of research into the subatomic world and so forth. Causality, for instance, which particularly in the Buddhist world is treated as higher than God as a personal being, causality doesn't hold in the subatomic world. So you see, we must be free of all these absurd ideas. It's necessary to be free, because if we are not free, we will not grow. We hold certain ideas as ultimate facts, ultimate truth. Well, if we stick to them, we do not advance any further. When the Buddha was enlightened at the age of 35, he didn't stop growing. He kept on advancing. This is one of the good things that Mahayana Buddhism has presented to us. It was when he was 51, he presented those teachings which formed the foundation of Mahayana Buddhism. So you see, there's no such thing as an ultimate final truth, and that is the end point. There is no end whatsoever where the manifested universe is concerned. There is a continual process of change. The change can be regressive, or it can be progressive in the real sense. And progressive change means that the mind becomes freer and freer, and more capable of penetrating into the actuality, whatever that actuality is. So I have tried during these months to free all of us who meet here from these absurd ideas. Consider again the descriptions of the transports in heaven and the tortures in hell. Look through all the religious descriptions in every religion, starting with Zarathustrianism. The descriptions of heaven and hell were not given by the founders of the religions. They were really beyond all that. They were too wise. It was their less developed, less perceptive followers who invented all these things. Now if you read them, you will see that every one of them is of the earth, earthy. And the immortal soul in an infinite and eternal sphere of being is supposed to go through torments or transports which are of the earth, earthy. How? It's completely and totally impossible. Now you see, this sort of conditioning, therefore, from which the human race continuously suffers, is one of the things which prevents humanity from realizing itself. To realize, for any human being to realize what it means to be truly and fully human. That is why I have been trying in my little way to free everybody from the conditioning imposed by these ideas. Now, of course, people will say, well, what have you to offer in its place? Nothing. I don't want to offer anything in its place. It is your business to discover for yourself. And I tell you why it is so important that nobody else shall try to put something in its place for you. Every single one of us is unique. You know that even two leaves on the same tree are different from each other. They are not absolutely alike. There is a uniqueness in each and every one of us. In some extraordinary, mysterious way, this is the marvel and the wonder, the mystery of the whole universal process. This primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy produced all this out of itself. It held all this in potentiality at, now this is the wrong word, but that is no word in any language to be the right word, at the start. Because there never was a start. There cannot be a start in eternity or infinity. There's no such thing as a beginning. We have to talk like that because our consciousness is so undeveloped that we must talk in terms of a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending. You see? This primordial creative energy emanated the entire universe as it is, as we see it. And one of the extraordinary things about it is that every single thing in the universe is utterly unique. Even atoms which are supposed to be fixed in their structure are not fixed in their structure. Some have an electron or two more or less than others of their own kind. You see, this indescribable, unimaginable uniqueness pervades the whole universe. So now, it behoves each and every one of us as a human being to discover his or her own uniqueness. And therefore, according to one's own uniqueness, you make your own path. I have said again and again that the path is your own psychophysical being. That is your path. Whatsoever happens in and through the psychophysical being, you grow, you evolve. Now, what do I mean by you evolve? You are no identifiable, a permanent identifiable entity. Every one of us is a phenomenon which undergoes continuous change, but whose origin is this primordial creative energy. You have to find out for yourself what you are like by self-examination all the time. This is where the whole teaching of mindfulness comes in. To be mindful of yourself. Now, one of the great difficulties in mindfulness is just this, that when we are awake to what we are thinking or doing, we already have in our conditioned brains a whole set of criteria to judge what we are doing. Be free of those criteria. This is the very great difficulty in the practice of mindfulness. If we are free of those criteria, then we will observe the fact as the fact. Otherwise we can't see the fact as the fact. Therefore, it becomes absolutely important to be free of all sorts of conditioning. Every kind of conditioning. No one can do it for you. You have to do it yourself. Can anyone breathe on your behalf? Can anyone else's heart beat on your behalf? Can anyone else's brain work on your behalf? You can't. You have to do it yourself. You must let it happen. When I say do it yourself, don't attempt to sort of gird your loins, as they say, and go out and fight the good fight, all that nonsense. Cut it right out. No one can fight the good fight. There is no such thing. Just observe quietly the process as it takes place. And observe how your conditioning works all the time. And as you observe that conditioning, you will find that it will gradually slip away. It will gradually dissolve, so to say. That psychical energy which works as conditioning will gradually change and become an energy which works as a liberator and not as a conditioner. This is important. That's how one is able to stand on one's own feet, in every sense of the word. Stand on one's own feet. And when you stand on your own feet and are free of all the imposed ideas and imposed conceptions, then you will discover that truth for yourself. The truth is the truth. It is the descriptions which are different. And simply because each one of us is different from everyone else, our own description has to be just our own description, which is suitable for us and effective for us. This is important. When one does that and succeeds to any extent, one will see how all ideas, beliefs are a hindrance to us. You know how Krishnamurti says always, out with every single belief. He's quite right, you know. At least I say so. Besides him. He's quite right. Out with every single belief, because whatever belief you hold conditions you. And you can't see the truth for yourself. And the manifested truth, remember, is a perpetually changing truth. That is why there should never be any fixation. The moment there is a mental fixation, you have ceased to grow. You get stuck in the mud. So observe in that manner. Or try to observe in that way, because one can't, I can't do it immediately, starting from where I am. I being a limited, ordinary human being, with all his flaws, his defects, his incapacities, his ignorance, and all the rest of it, I can't do it on my own straight away. But gradually work at it, work at it, work at it. And never cease working at it, go for it. Perpetually, constantly. And you will find your particular path, as it is called. The path which is a path in freedom and in happiness, in real happiness. In short, you as the bud will open out, blossom out into the perfect flower. That's how it will happen. And when it happens that way, you will discover something quite extraordinary. You will experience a unification with everyone around you. That is one of the great and powerful expressions of transcendent love, love in its true sense. That unification makes no demand, no possessive demand, no expectation, no wanting a return or an acknowledgement or anything at all. It will be love which is an unconditional and unreserved total giving of one's whole self to the object of love. And the object of love will be the totality around you. But one has to be free from inside. If one is not free from inside, there will be demands all the time. Our reptilian claws will be out. You see? Look how terribly those reptilian claws work when parents want to impose upon their children a particular career or a particular this, that or the other. We say it is natural. Yes, it is natural because we are at our subhuman stage. That is all. When we are free of all that, then we are truly human. Human. Hu or su. Su in Sanskrit is interchangeable with Avastan and Pali H, you see, means happy. That which has blossomed out, flowered out, things have come to fruition. That is what the meaning of the H-U part. And the man part, don't look into the dictionary for it because it will give you a very partial meaning, means to think. But what is this kind of thinking? The divine thinking, what is it? The thought in the mind of God, as it is put in the old scriptures, you see, is that which creates, brings into being. You know how in Genesis we say, and God said, and whatever he said came into being. Can you and I just utter a word, a say, let there be £1,000,000 in the bank for me, and you'll find £1,000,000 in the bank? You won't. You see? Said means minded. Can you and I mind something in that manner? We can't. Mind is a universal archetypal energy. It expresses the formative side of the manifest of the creative energy in action. It is the formative aspect. It is universal, it cannot be possessed. Because whatsoever belongs to the context of the infinite and the eternal can never be possessed by anybody. You can only possess that which is finite and temporal, and that for the time being, and therefore it is mortal. Therefore, no one can possess anything. I say finite and temporal, but at the same time we must remember that the finite is also infinite. Look, we say that this body perishes. What do we mean by it? We see a phenomenon. This fellow was born about this big, you see, and he grew and grew. He's lived his life, and when he's 260 years old, he will die. In fact, he will die before very long, in actual fact. He will die, and we say, oh, he's dead. He's perished. Then he's cremated or buried or whatever happens, you see, and we say he's gone. But who is this he who has gone, and where has he gone? Nowhere. Matter is immortal. Look, take a lump of paper. Weigh it. Try to destroy it, say by burning it. Weigh the gases evolved, the ash which is left behind. You will find that the combined weight of all these things is exactly the same weight as the original lump of paper. Isn't that so, Alan?
It will have increased.
Increased?
Because it's taken up oxygen.
Ah. Yes. Yes, I mean, and weigh every aspect of the thing, you see, the oxygen. If you weigh the oxygen used, plus the weight of the paper, and the ash and the gases which may be evolved, you will find that the two weights are equal. What has happened? The shape the form of that matter which we had as a lump of paper has changed form. But matter, the matter that was in the lump of paper, it has remained the same in all the products that have come about. So you see, actually the context of existence truly is the eternal and the infinite and the immortal. But we, our consciousness hasn't evolved that far. Now, let me come to the important point, to the important point here. What is the purpose of our human existence? What is happening through each one of us as a human being? Consciousness is evolving. We are at present conscious in terms of the finite and temporal. And therefore, we are conscious, and especially because of the functioning of our senses, we are conscious in terms of separativeness and isolativeness. And therefore, we are never in complete and relationship with the totality around us. That is how we are conscious. And because we are conscious separatively and isolatively, there is conflict, there is war, there is sorrow, there is misery, destruction, and so forth. This isolative, separative consciousness is the fundamental meaning of being born in sin. Sin is that which tends to hurt or destroy the unity of the universe. Now, if we awake to the fact that our consciousness is like that now, and we take ourselves in hand and free ourselves from all our conditioning and so forth, then that consciousness evolves till it becomes a holistic consciousness, which means that consciousness has become aware in terms of unitary wholeness. In that unitary wholeness, everything is held. Now, you might say, but good gracious, that is what they say God is. Yes, you are God. A little God. Remember that each and every one of us is a microcosm. And as a microcosm, we are the actual representative, the vice regent, if you like, of the macrocosm. Each one of us is like a holographic representation of the totality. That is what we are like, really. That is our potentiality. So now, consciousness has to evolve into that condition. That is one of the purposes of human existence. There are several other purposes, but we have no time today to discuss them, you see. If we realize that, if we can begin to see that properly, we will be able to put ourselves on the right path. That is our own path, which expresses our own uniqueness. You see? Now don't think of that uniqueness merely as being different from the other fellow. That's all nonsense. We are different up to a point, but in a much profounder way, we are identical. That identity, that unitariness, has become split up in the course of manifestation. And therefore we are like this. So, it is towards that which we must work, and that is the real purpose of the religious life, I should say. The great spiritual teachers were people who had this holistic consciousness. They were conscious in terms of the infinite and the eternal. And they were also perfectly conscious and masters of the finite and temporal consciousness and its functioning in the world of everyday affairs. So you see, the living of the good life is for that purpose, and it is not something which I win or I gain. Cut out every vestige of selfness. There is nothing whatsoever for me, the particular individual, who is known in this world by his own name. Nothing whatsoever. If you can really see that and are prepared to live by what by that, when you really see it, then you will live the human life, the really valuable life, the beautiful life. That is the beautiful life. And in that sort of living, what we call love and wisdom and goodness and truth and beauty, whose real meanings we don't know yet, will all emerge out of our own everyday life. You will be the light of the world, each one.